Good morning. I'm Robert Reynolds, and it's my distinct privilege this morning to record a conversation with my esteemed mentor and colleague and longtime friend, Carr L. White. Carr is a physician whose entire professional life has been devoted to improving the health of his fellow man through a study and delivery of healthcare services. Carr himself has been a practitioner of healthcare services, but more significantly, his keen insights and his studies and his analyses of the organization and the financing and the practices of healthcare have in fact led to and were pioneering efforts in the foundation of a brand new field of medicine in the 1960s and 1970s, which we now call health services research. And Carr is one of the people internationally recognized for the founding of this new field. And it's my privilege this morning to talk to Carr about his career and how he became interested in this field and what his contributions to it were and where it may be going in the future. So Carr, maybe you might start by telling us something about your formative years and how you ended up choosing a career in medicine rather than in something else.
Well, Bob, thanks very much for initiating this conversation about the healthcare collection that the University of Virginia has now in its Health Sciences Library. It's a collection basically of ideas. Various people were interested in bits and parts of the collection until you arranged to take the whole thing, which shows the relationships of many aspects of health and disease and the efforts to ameliorate it and improve it. As for the influences in my early days, I suppose we could start with being at home. One of my father's best friends was Robert Coates, and he started the Canadian Health Statistics Canada. He started the health statistics operation there, and our home was flooded with reports of statistics of various kinds. I didn't read them all or even peruse them all, but I did see some of them, and I was kind of interested in hearing him talk about it and read these, so I got interested in statistics at an early date. Another important influence was when I was at Yale in the graduate school, was a professor there, Elliot Dunlap Smith, and he introduced us to approaches to management and to the ways of empowering employees. He'd worked for the Denison Company, the paper company, and they had a number of different practices that were, when they concerned with the welfare and health of their patients, they improved productivity. So that was a very important influence to me. Another one was my first job was the RCA Victor Company in Montreal. I was in the personnel department, and I was given the job of paying off the part-time piece workers, and they would get terrible payments of $14.21 and $16.59. They break down in tears. Their boyfriends and husbands and brothers and fathers were off in the war. And I thought this was terrible. So with some other people, we organized a strike, and we closed down the RCA Victor Company factory for several weeks, and we resulted in the strike produced a great improvement in their wages and their stability and their benefits, and that's one of the prouder episodes of my early career. When I went to medical school, one of the early things we did there, we didn't see that the curriculum was really designed to prepare physicians. It was sort of bits and pieces of all kinds. So a group of us got together and wrote a very strong letter to the dean, the powers that be, of the way to reorganize the curriculum of the medical school. And however, I was befriended by J.S.L. Brown, who was the chairman of the Department of Medicine. He wasn't much of a clinician, but he was a great, wonderful person. And he, I remember as a clinician, you've probably heard of Oscar Peterson, the jazz pianist, and Oscar Peterson's father was in the hospital, and Oscar was there every day, and J.S.L. Brown diagnosed a pneumonia when, in fact, he had a perforated peptic ulcer, as we found out later on. But J.S.L. Brown, at the time, he was involved in the introduction of cortisone, and there were no really clinical trials in those days. This was back in the 40s, 1940s. And I remember he had the residents going around asking the patients whether they felt better. Well, they all felt better, but they didn't distinguish between the placebo effect and the intrinsic effect of cortisone. I remember one of the faculty telling the patient to take this and you'll feel better. One of the other episodes in my medical career was the professor of public health. And the public health was characterized then as lectures. For example, we had one on how to can tomatoes to avoid potane poisoning. And the other one was how to build sanitary privies. And I thought, my God, if that's what public health is all about, we've got some problems. But then I found the writings of John Ryle, who was the Regius Professor of Medicine at Cambridge, and he had moved to the University of Oxford to found a new institute for social medicine. And Ryle had written a wonderful textbook of medicine and a number of other writings. A lot of these things are in the library, actually. And I was quite intrigued by this and was going to spend a fellowship year with him in Oxford, but he died prematurely. Let's see, what other things? I then went on to internship residency. I decided to go in internal medicine because I thought that's where the power was. I'd previously been in surgery, but the internists were sort of taking over, and I thought I should get training in that. I looked at I could have stayed on at McGill, but I didn't feel like spending a year as an intern running around with a syringe gathering blood from work in the laboratory. So I looked at the Mary Imogene Bassett hospitals, the three Marys in Cooperstown, and the Mary Fletcher Hospital in Burlington, where actually I ended up later in Burlington, and then the Mary Hitchcock Clinic in Dartmouth, where I went. And I got superb clinical training there. It's the best medical care I've ever encountered anywhere. And I really enjoyed the training. Sven Gunderson had opted to go to the Mary Hitchcock rather than stay at Harvard. He was the head cardiologist and head of medicine, was very good. A good friend of mine, Bill Chambers, I worked with him quite a bit, and we did some studies of angina pectoris and of the pseudoangia, as we called it in that day, and also of cardiac failure, and we published a number of papers. But I felt I got very good clinical training there, and friendships I made there carried on still. Then I went back to McGill for a fellowship year, and among my activities there, I developed a position paper about two or three pages long in which I set up a kind of institute for research into health care, medical care. I forget what I actually called it. J.S.L. Brown, the chair of medicine, and others said, oh, this is a wonderful idea, it's a great thing. He said, come back in 25 years. He said, we're not ready for that yet.
Right.
So that was the end of that. But J.S.L. Brown, I could have stayed on at McGill, but I would have had a heck of a time making a living within two or three hospitals and sort of minimal faculty pay. And he introduced me to the Commonwealth Fund and Lester Evans. And they were then funding a number of some old and some new schools for what they call comprehensive medicine. I had looked into this in some detail, and actually with J.S.L. Brown, he was agreed to be a co-author of a paper on comprehensive medicine that we published in the Canadian Medical Association. And I'd published a few sort of outrageous articles in the McGill Medical Journal on medical care that were kind of an interest. But Lester Evans introduced me to the University of North Carolina, which was the first new medical school. It had been a two-year school, but it was the first new medical school after World War II. And they agreed to, they offered me a job. So we decamped for Chapel Hill. My wife thought we were going to fall off the edge of the planet going down there. But it's a beautiful community, a wonderful place, and we went down there. And I started off as an assistant professor. Frank Williams, who was there at the same time, he later became director of the National Institute for Aging and is still a good friend. He and I were in charge of the outpatient department. I was largely in charge of research there. We did one on medical errors, which I think was the first study of medical errors in ambulatory care. We thought we ran a pretty tight ship. But we really looked at the number of diagnoses that were not really followed up, the number of lab things that were not followed up, x-rays not taken, letters not written to physicians. We found all kinds of problems, so we published an article. That was in the Journal of Chronic Diseases, which had metamorphed from the Journal of Venereal Diseases when they collapsed, and was Journal of Chronic Diseases. Now it's the Journal of Clinical Anesthesiology. We did that. Then we started a large referral practice, study. I was interested in knowing when the patients came to the clinic whether we were really responding to their needs and were dealing appropriately with their problems. And this referral study, it was statewide, and it was done with a probability sample of physicians and then their patients. And it provided a number of insights into what we were doing well and doing wrong. At Chapel Hill also, I was befriended by and enjoyed the really learning a great deal from Bernie Greenberg, who was professor of health statistics there at the time. And he introduced me to critical thinking about clinical trials. We did a clinical trial with him on hypertension, which I think was one of the first done in this country. Not the first by any means, but it was soon after the one done in Britain by Bradford Hill. And then also John Castle, who was the first sort of social epidemiologist this country's had. He died at a very early age.
Well, Carl, one of the things that occurs to me as you speak is the difference between you and so many physicians of your generation who were taught to and who were very efficient at focusing on individual patients one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. And what you seem to have realized was that the society has to look at populations of patients, not just individual patients. And by looking at populations, you discover patterns and errors and omissions and triumphs that you might not just see looking one at a time at your own patient population. And I think that's one of the contributions you made, was to alert us all to how to look at the health of the public, not just one patient at a time.
Well, I greatly enjoyed looking after patients in the Department of Medicine, and I had a fair practice. I used to make house calls and took care of patients at home, took care of even dying patients at home, and I enjoyed that immensely. But I also, wondered whether we're really responding appropriately to all their needs. And when Chapel, when the University of North Carolina started, opened, they had a symposium. That was before I arrived there, about 8 or 10 months before I got there. But one of the speakers was Jerry Morris, and I'll refer to him more in a minute, but he gave a paper there that was later published in the British Medical Journal on the uses of epidemiology, and later it was produced as a book, The Uses of Epidemiology. And there are several copies of that in the library. It went into several different editions. But in there, he showed the patients' problems and looking at populations of them and studying patterns. And I think it was Jerry Morris that really led me into thinking these sorts of thinking about problems in this kind of a way. And I am certainly much indebted to him. We stay in touch. He's now about 96, I think. He's still in London. He's just done a study of the basic minimum costs of in terms of housing and health care and food and clothing and so on required to maintain health in London. It's a very interesting study that he's published.
Well, one other point I would make, and we didn't ask you a lot about your growing up years, but it seems to me that because you entered medical school a bit later than most of your generation did, and after you'd had real life experiences working on a shipboard, working with the transportation industry, working at RCA, and being a soldier for the Canadian Army, that you came to medical school with a different perspective than the person right out of college who hasn't had those real life experiences.
Well, my class cohort, we were virtually all veterans, except the women. I think we had a class of about 140, and I think maybe 12, 15 were women. The rest were virtually all veterans.
In their late 20s then?
in our late 20s,
right, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that makes a difference. I think the maturity level when you enter medical school makes a lot of difference on how you look at medicine.
Yes, I think it did make a difference,
One of the things that I think we'd really love to hear from you is how and under what circumstances what I call the paradigmatic breakthroughs occurred. That is to say, looking at the ecology of public medicine and looking at what later we call health services research. I'm particularly interested in how those two things evolved in your career and how you helped spawn those as a national and an international interest and in an area of focus.
Well, the paradigm, I think, arose in my year in London. The statistical training under Bradford Hill and the influence of Jerry Morris and the questions he had, and then a number of people that I met at the time. Two of them were John and Elizabeth Horder, and they were general practitioners. They were trained actually as internists, the highest level of consultants or fellows of the Royal College of Physicians and so on. But they had a wonderful practice, and I made rounds with particularly with John Horder on several occasions, house calls and so on. But they had examined their own practice and looked at the number of patients that had problems, the number they had to refer, and then the number went to hospitals. And it was their own practice, but the nested squares were in their article, which was published in the, I think it was called The Practitioners. There's a copy of it with the reprints in the library. But that had an important effect on me. And then Jerry Morris's way of looking at things. And then John Brotherston, who I met up, who was initially professor of social medicine in the University of Edinburgh, then dean, and then chief medical officer in Scotland. And he was a remarkable individual. He produced a series of brochures about how individual practitioners, how health officers, how other entities that influence health should think of the problems and so on. And the whole series of those is in the library. But they had a big effect on the whole thing. Then the question of the sort of quality, Archie Cochran, I visited him. In fact, he told me that epidemiology had no place to play in the evaluation of medical care. Of course, he had a great epiphany later on and changed when he came up with his book, Effectiveness and Efficiency. These influences. Then Gordon McLaughlin was head of the Nuffield Provincial Hospitals Trust. Later started a series. He hadn't started when I was there, but we were both talking about it. But the series on problems and progress in patient care was a series. Now the whole series of the Nuffield publications is in the library, and there's a whole series going right up to date, I think, and that's quite a remarkable documentation. But when I returned to Chapel Hill after this, Chuck Burnett, who'd been my sort of mentor, he became ill and was away almost a whole year, and it was succeeded by Lou Welp, who was a nephrologist of considerable note, but he didn't have much time for primary care or for family medicine or what we were doing in the general clinic. And he was in the wave of the biomedical subspecialties and so on. But he was an eminent figure. But I went to see him. I said, well, the Commonwealth Fund's coming down to see if they'll renew our grant. And we talked about it. He said, well, just tell them we spent the money. And I was furious, and I went back to my office, and that's when I started writing this paper, The Ecology of Medical Care, which used the ideas from Horder and Brotherston and Jerry Morris and these other individuals to frame that paper, and we introduced the term primary medical care. Actually, the term primary care was introduced by Lord Dawson in 1920 in the famous Dawson Report. I had not read that and didn't know of it at the time. That was my ignorance of it. But anyhow, we included in that. And then Joe Garland, the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, he took the paper completely, didn't make any changes. He said, I just want to change the title. I said, I don't like the word ecology. I said, well, the ecology is in the title. He said, if you don't want it, why send the paper back? So he took it. And
it became famous.
That's how it got started and how the squares, how they arose.
Well, I'm sort of going to try to follow that thread, because eventually when you and I met, You had just started the new department at the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins, and you interested me, a young internist who had a view of the health of the public as well as the health of individuals, to come study with you. And I'd be curious as to what led up to and who had the brilliance to say, we need a new department in the School of Public Health, because until that time, they were not really very ingenious nor looking forward into the future.
Well, I think we have to credit John Hume with that, who was the dean at the time, and probably maybe he was the deputy dean at the time, and Ernest Stebbins was the dean. But Herb Klarman, who was I think one of the first health economists in the country, they had recruited him. I guess John Hume had. And Herb Klarman, he was on the study section. I was asked to be on the study section at, I guess when I was at University of North Carolina, that's when we got the name changed from hospital facility study section, which was concerned with noise in the garbage cans and problems in the central supply place and that sort of thing. Why don't we consider what the hospitals are for and look at the patient's problems? Mm-hmm. We got the name changed to Health Service Research. Well, Herb Klarman was on the study section at that time. And I think it was Herb who gave my name, said, you know, got this wild-eyed character in the on the study section. He gave my name to John Hume. And I'd been only up at the University of Vermont for about 15, 18 months when they approached me. Apparently, they've been thinking about this for a while, and so I made a decision to go to Hopkins, and I thought, you know, they offered me a lot of real estate and a big budget, not a great deal increase in salaries. I was getting pretty generous a salary for that time up at Vermont, but there's all this real estate and all this budget and so on, and I thought, well, you can say things from Hopkins that you probably can't say from the University of Vermont. I said, it's a crazy way to run things, but that's the way the world works. So I moved to Hopkins, and I figured the important thing were the students.
So you trained a generation of people who are now leaders in healthcare policy and healthcare research and health services research that I think is really quite a testimony to the insight you had and your ability to build a department, found it, and to spawn new leaders in the field.
Well, it was the students who did it, and when I got there, well, there was myself and a desk and a chair and an empty room, and I got a secretary. And the first faculty person I appointed was Barbara Starfield, and she came and said, you know, this is going to be a high-risk operation. And so she thought about it, and she came back in tears and said, yes, I'm willing to start, and so on. And now she's university distinguished professor and sort of leader in primary care around the world pretty well. But the students started coming, and they certainly were the lifeblood of the department. I think you were one of the first students, actually, if not the first.
I was.
And Vincent Navarro, who came in, he was sent to me by John Brotherston, actually, from Edinburgh. Poor Vincent, he got off the boat in New York, and the first thing he did in the land of the free and the home of the brave was to have his overcoat stolen.
But such people as Robert Brooke, Jack Wenberg, Bob Blendon, others are all now national leaders thanks to your insight.
Well, of course, you're vice president of the University of Virginia, Bob Brooks, vice president of RAND Corporation, Jack Wenberg, that was an idea from Jerry Morris, the Glover phenomenon. Jerry Morris introduced me to that, in which Glover had studied. He was a physician and health officer in England. He'd studied tonsillectomy rates in different towns that were similar in other respects, and there were vast differences in the rates, and the question of whether morbidity was different, whether the surgeons were different, and what the problems were. And I introduced a hospital abstract system in Vermont, including the Medical Society putting me on the carpet and saying, this is a communist plot, it's got to be nicked in the bud.
Those were the times.
Those were the times. But that system we got Jack Wenberg up to Vermont to start exploiting that, and then he published an article with Alan Gittleson, who was a professor of statistics at Hopkins in science, and then he went on to found the Dartmouth Center for the Evaluation of Health Sciences and start that up. Of course, Bob Blendon, we had five full professors at Harvard at one time, and Bob Blendon and Marie McCormick, head of the department. Little Marie, I remember her, she was a short little person. She's got a named chair as head of maternal and child health, Bob Blendon. Then we had Tom Enwe and the Fletchers, who were in ambulatory medicine there. And let's see, who else? We had Felix Gutzwiller, who was head of the Institute of Social Medicine at Zurich. And then we had Esko Kelimo.
What we might talk about is when the chapter at Hopkins began to close and you went up to Rockefeller, tell us how that liaison was made and what it meant to you and what developed from the Rockefeller chapter of your life.
I had known John Knowles a long time, and he and I had sort of deplored the separation of the schools of public health and schools of medicine. And I remember we had a talk one, I think it was a AAMC meeting down in Houston, talked about it. And he asked me up for an interview. He became president of the Rockefeller Foundation. He'd been head of the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And he asked me up for an interview. We talked about it, but he wanted a lot of stuff done on tropical diseases as well as health care. And I was not onto tropical diseases particularly and not knowledgeable about them, so I sort of withdrew from that. But then later on, and Ken Warren took the head of director of the Health Sciences Division, and he was a great student, knowledgeable about schistosomiasis and various other tropical diseases. And then John Knowles and Ken Warren asked me to come up and talk about being deputy director. And then we talked about what could be done. And I sketched out something like the International Clinical Epidemiology Network, what we might do, bringing training clinicians in epidemiology so they could apply it in their practices. This was an idea that was developed again from England. John Pemberton founded the International Epidemiological Association, and we had run a number of meetings in the developing world, helping clinicians, usually internists, sometimes pediatricians, learn a little bit about epidemiology. They were one-week sort of things, but they'd been quite successful, and I thought this was a good model to use, and I used it for developing NCLIN. So I joined the Rockefeller Foundation, and we proceeded with this. Unfortunately, John Knowles became quite ill within a few months after my getting there, and he subsequently died at a very early age. So we had some difficulty kind of getting going, but eventually we got it launched, and we set up three training centers, one at McMaster University, which where Dave Sackett was. He'd come down to a session that we were running at Hopkins. We ran some sessions on, we called it health services research, but there were sort of clinical epidemiology sessions, one-week sessions with the AAMC, and he'd been at one of those. And I knew he was evolving in these. So one of them was Edward McMaster, one was with Paul Stolle at University of Pennsylvania, and the other one was the University of Newcastle, which I'd heard about. It was a new medical school in quite a long time in Australia. And then later we set up the UNC at Chapel Hill with the Fletchers, and we started training young clinicians. They all had to have a faculty appointment in medicine or pediatrics. Some were in obstetrics, occasionally in psychiatry, but most of them were internists and pediatricians. And it's been going now for well over 25 years. It's still going strong. The original headquarters were, of course, we ran it out of Rockefeller, then later out of Philadelphia for quite a while, and they still have an office in Philadelphia. And then in the Philippines in Manila, and we had directors who morphed into local indigenous people. And then in the current one is New Delhi at the All Institute for Medical Sciences, All India Institute for Medical Sciences in New Delhi. And I think the figures are roughly now, we've trained about 1,400 clinicians health economists, health statisticians, and social scientists, and they work in groups of about 8 or 9 or 10, mostly in clinical departments and medical schools. And there are now, I think the figure is something like 80 units of these units around the developing world, and I think they're operating, I'm not sure the latest figures, but it's something like 40 or 50 different countries and then all five continents. So they're just going strong. Rockefeller supported for a long time. They have a lot of AID money, and they've had various other grants. Now, most of the original people have now gone on to become full professors, chairs, deans, a number of them, some of them ministers of health and so on, and advisors. And it's, I think, been successful. It evoked a lot of criticism from schools of public health. What have they got doing, taking over our territory? Actually, epidemiology started by clinicians. It was all in medical schools initially until 1916, when the first school of public health was set up at Hopkins. And then it was taken over when the medical schools opted not to get involved in these things. It was taken over by the schools of public health. But it was all the London Epidemiological Society was a major organization in Britain. And so we try to, you know, these... most of the new ideas are not all that good, and a lot of the old ideas are still pretty good. So these were all old ideas that we proceeded with. Albert Einstein, actually the term clinical epidemiology was introduced by John Paul, a professor of medicine at Yale, at a meeting of the Young Turks in Atlantic City. And then Albert Einstein developed it, of course, at Yale quite a bit, too.
Well, the listeners might like to know that Carr... who is sitting across the table to me and looks like he's 70, is about to be 90. Carr was born in 1917, just as the First World War was reaching its most energetic and violent peak. And Carr retired, but he didn't really retire. Carr is the most widely read person I know in medicine and health-related issues, and he was willing, when he moved to Charlottesville, to donate his library, his personal library of well over 2,000 volumes and monographs, to the Health Sciences Library, where he is still the most frequent patron I know of, coming and going to this library and using it for his own writings and analyses and papers. So on behalf of the university, Carr, I want to thank you for lodging your library here and for continuing to swell it with new books and new articles. One of the things I'd like to ask you is, it's sort of personal. What would you like to think is your legacy to medicine and healthcare when you are no longer with us? And what advice might you have for the people today who are in policy-making positions in health and healthcare and health issues and their practitioners?
Well, I think the legacy has to be determined by other people, and one can't do it oneself. I guess the things that please me most are our students, our graduates, and what they've done. And they're my tangible legacy, and in turn the students and the people that they're teaching and bringing along. I don't know, I like to think the strike at the RCA Victor was a benefit to some people years ago.
I understand you were a target of investigation by the Royal Mounted Police.
Oh yes, well, I'd probably be doing a hard time cracking rocks somewhere.
Good for you.
I guess promoting primary care was one of the things I like too. And then starting the, we cooked up the idea. And did I mention that? And the cooking up the idea of the National Center for Health Service Research. Well, we had a meeting of the Health Service Research Study Section. Then several of us repaired to the bar afterwards, and I sketched out the idea of the National Center for Health Service Research. We went back to the AANC, and I got Bill Hubbard. Let me say a few words about the importance of doing this, and I was met with stony silence.
I'll bet.
But we lobbied, and eventually I lobbied Ted Kennedy's outfit, and he had hearings, and we got the thing going in 1968. So there were a lot of problems with that. I think Health United States, which is a volume published by the National Center for Health Statistics every year, is I like to think it was useful. I got the idea from Sri Lanka. They put out a similar document that was good for Sri Lanka. It might be good for the United States.
And what is in this book, Gordon?
Well, it's a compendium of all the health statistics, the surveys, and there are usually one or two featured sections on particular things each year. When that was first produced by the National Center, it made the front pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Pages, and had been signed off by the then Secretary of Health. And Dorothy Rice was the head of health statistics. She got a telephone call. What the hell is all this about?
Yes. So it's a yearly update of statistics, yeah, and trends
quite a few
in healthcare.
Of them in the library. I suppose, there are also disappointments in the legacy. I guess the downsizing of primary care, which I think is a tragedy in this country at the present time, and also our failure to have universal health insurance with 46 million people. So it's a kind of mixed bag. You wish we thought at one time we'd be having universal health service. We thought primary care would flourish. So those were sort of disappointments. But the legacy has to be determined by others. We'll wait and see.
And your advice for the current generation and future generations?
I have a little plaque that I've had above my desk for decades that reads, "Shun advice at any price." That's what I call good advice.
All right.
I don't know. I think getting a proper health information system, one of the areas that you've been so involved in, we have a money-based health information system in this country. What we need is a patient-based, starting with their problems and their symptoms, complaints, and then building up to diseases and to the interventions and the outcomes. And that's the sort of health information. So I think one of the important things for the future is a really adequate health information system. And that will evolve thanks to efforts of people like yourself. I think we get a lot of talk about data. You know, the New Yorker once had a phrase that said, "We've got roomfuls of data untouched by human thought." And I think we need to T.S. Eliot wrote a poem on this. I used to quote it. I forget the details of it. But we need to get the transition of data into information and then have it interpreted with wisdom. So I think we need more wisdom. We need to go a lot of the things that have gone before, perhaps read some of the books in the collection and understand what our forefathers have thought about some of these problems. Again, I think for the future, develop a primary healthcare. All the other developed countries have strong primary care foundations. Barbara Starfield has studies showing that they're cost effective, their costs are less than an adequate primary care foundation. And then universal health insurance for the future.
I remember when I was one of your students in the 60s learning that the United States keep spending more and more dollars per capita on health, perhaps 50% as much as 50% more than the European nations and Canada, yet our health statistics don't compare to theirs, and we seem to be spending more money on disease and less on prevention and health. And we still have that problem, and we still have the emphasis on specialty care rather than primary care and prevention. And that one of your legacies is to keep pointing that out.
Well, it'll be the future to sort it out, too.
Well, Carr, on behalf of the listeners of this tape, I want to thank you for your career and for your friendship and leadership and for sitting here and rehearsing some of it with us.
Well, thank you for listening to all this.
Thank you.
Right.